The Triathlon Show 403. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Richard Laidlow. Richard is somebody that many of you have heard of as the father and coach of Sam Laidlow. In this interview, we discuss what it's like to coach Sam. We go into details around his training, but we also have a long discussion around coaching and training advice for age group athletes, because Richard does work with age groupers just as he does professionals. But before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. Precision Fuel and Hydration help athletes perform at their best with electrolyte and fueling products, and with free online tools, education, and a patented sweat test. You can use the free fuel and hydration planner on their website to get a personalized plan for your carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake. And you can also book a free 20-minute video consultation to chat through your plan with the athlete support team. I have used their entire range of products for a long time, and I think they're absolutely brilliant. You can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS23 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Zen8. The Zen8 indoor swim trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency, even when you're short on time. It's a great tool for busy athletes because you can do a quality workout in just 15 minutes at home, even on days when you don't have time to go to the pool. And it is a perfect complement to pool and open water swimming, as it allows you to focus specifically on key aspects of your swimming, like your catch and your power, and isolate them more easily than you can in the water. You can try the Zen8 risk-free for up to 30 days, so if you don't love it, just send it back, and you can get 20% off your first order on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Richard Laidlow. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, Richard. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me on. All hot and busy down here, so it's all good.
Yeah, maybe tell the listeners, where are you based, actually?
We are based in France. They're probably one of the most southerly parts of France, right on the Spanish-French border, not far between, sat in between sort of Girona, as a cycling mecca of Europe at the moment, and Perpignan.
Right. And maybe we can use that as a lead into a bit more about you and your background within endurance sports as an athlete and coach, and also the training camps that you're running.
Yes, absolutely. I've been here, based down in the south of France now for 22 years. From a coaching perspective, from a triathlon perspective, I've been doing triathlon since I was 14, or got introduced to triathlon when I was 14, and probably took it up seriously when I was 17, 18, coming from a swimming background. I was in the military as a physical training instructor for a number of years, and that's where I got into coaching triathlon and coaching people in perspective. Then I had enough of the military. I wasn't really a military person. I don't like to shave every day, as you can tell. So then I started lecturing. I met Michelle, my now wife, and she was lecturing in art and design. And they were looking for sports science lecturers and physical training lecturers as well. So I got an opportunity to start lecturing at a sort of further education level, from sort of 16 up to sort of whatever age, 60-year-old. Some of the people I used to lecture, and I did that for about 7 years before then. We both decided to come down to the south of France and focus on setting up triathlon training camps here in Amelie-les-Bains, a place called Sanctuaire Sportifs. So we've been doing that now for 22 years, introducing both Sam and his brother Jake into the world of triathlon through the amount of people that we get through our doors.
Yeah, can you tell us a bit more about that? How you run your camps, because it's a bit different than your traditional training camps.
Yeah, I mean, it's a home from home, really. The training camps, people come out here, we look at smaller numbers. We don't look at sort of big numbers and getting sort of 20, 30 athletes, 40 athletes out at a time and having two or three coaches at a time. People come out with out to us, and either I'm coaching them or guiding them, depending on where they actually come from and if they've got a coach or if they've got any ideas of what their training is about. They are integrated into the family, so they are part of the actual house itself. the eat dinner with us. We basically, Michelle caters and looks after them as much as you would if you were sort of at home. So they get to see the life of a pro athlete from it, sort of from a homely perspective, not from sort of, okay, I'm sat at in a big training camp in sort of standard accommodation. It is, they're part of the house.
Yeah, no, that's a really cool concept. We've talked about this before, but yeah. I really like what you're doing there. Let's move into some questions around coaching, and I thought that we can break it up into basically two parts, because I know a lot of listeners will be interested in your coaching of Sam, of course, Sam Laidlaw.
Yeah.
And we can start with that, and then we move into some more like general coaching questions that how they might apply to others as well. But yeah, let's start with, what is it like to coach your son? Is it very different due to the relationship that you have compared to coaching others?
I won't say so. No, it's not that much. It's not that different. I mean, the benefit is I get to see him on a daily basis. So, okay, the stats and everything else from sort of his HRV, et cetera, might be all sort of good. Yeah, but I actually get to see him face to face and actually speak to them. And that's one of the things, again, what we see in the training camps as well. Obviously, you can communicate with people. You see him on a daily basis. You can see how tired they are. And it's the same sort of with Jake, with Sam, sorry. It's like sort of they come in and I can see Sam in the morning, go, oh, is he going to have a good day? Is he going to have a bad day? And sort of can adapt training on a daily basis. And going through sort of Arthur Hosel, who won Ironman Nice, again, his development has been when he came in, and when I could actually see him on a daily basis. Yeah, because you can get so much more feedback than you can just from looking at the data itself.
So Arthur and Sam are now training, basically doing all the sessions together, is that right? And he's living very close to you guys?
Yes, yeah, we've got Archer and Sam, and then Jake is joining in. Now he's in his summer holidays, and we're actually taking him out and homeschooling him from September onwards. And then also we have another, I won't say younger triathlete, a new sort of French triathlete coming through called Senzino Legout. He is, again, a youngster, just finished his sort of studies, and he's locally from this region. And so we've got a little community together now where they're all training together. Now, all of them are at different levels. And so obviously training needs to be adapted, but it does make sort of swimming up and down the swimming pool or going for a run a little bit more interesting. But they're still doing their own separate things depending on where their strengths and weaknesses are.
So in terms of Sam's training, then, can you characterize it in some way? And this might be one of those questions that we talked before that you said would be a bit difficult to answer, but give it a shot.
No, I mean, I try and keep Sam's training as consistent as possible. It's always been about consistency. And so we have a weekly structure, and that weekly structure then is sort of developed depending on where those needs and where they are. So, for example, like today's Mondays, we have a swim session, which at the moment is based on race pace, so Ironman race pace. We did a little bit of difference today. It was a little bit quicker, but as the PTO championships are coming up, PTO Singapore are coming up, so therefore we just did a little bit more speed work, but still sort of having race pace intervals. And then he's gone out and done sort of a four-hour zone two ride. Now this is where they'll set off, like all of them will set off together, and depending on how they feel, but everybody's zone two is slightly different. So therefore they quite often either hang on to each other's wheels or they actually split up completely. But today sort of thing, it's a zone two, 4 hour ride. Tuesdays we look at doing a brick session, so a bike into a run. The bike is very Ironman focused at the moment, and the run is a little bit of speed, a little bit of just short. So, for example, it'd be a minute on, 30 off, or 45 on, 45 off, depending, just very VO2 work, which we don't do a lot of, to be honest. And then also looking at sort of stability, strength, proprioceptive training to help sort of the stabilization during running and swimming as well, and keeping all of the smaller muscles and everything else as strong and as flexible as it possibly can. Then we look into sort of a Wednesday, which is a bit more of an endurance day. So again, we get another swim in, so the second swim of the week, where we look at sort of working on endurance and getting the pace. So again, zone two sort of training. And more or less straight away, we then go in and do a long run. So that long run could be anything up to 2.5 to 2:45 run. Again, at the moment, looking at sort of Ironman pacing, so over-unders, let's say, of Ironman pacing. So they get the actual body used to actually running. And at the moment, it's really good. It's good training because obviously it's super hot down here, and it helps. And we can get the nutrition and get the hydration all dialed in, because this is one of the issues that Sam has had in the past is he sweats 3 liters an hour. So trying to replace 3 liters an hour is actually pretty difficult. So when we're actually training in that, we can actually put it and test and do things together to make sure that everything's working well together. Thursday is a long bike. It varies. I mean, obviously, we've got Ironman, the World Championships down in Nice, so it's very much more hill-based, and getting climbing, staying in on the dry bars, getting the right sort of muscular strength, muscular endurance on the actual hills itself. Friday is an easier day. We still get to swim in, which is more technique based. But I mean, still technique based. We still get 6K done in that swim session. So I wouldn't say it's actually easier. People think that sort of technique work is actually easier, and from a strength perspective, it isn't as easy as what they expect. And I remember that as a sort of an athlete. Oh, great! I've got technique day today, and actually worked out harder than a hard day. And then also we'll do sort of an hour and a half of run drills, strengthening up and everything else for Sam on that. Then Saturday, we sort of alternate sort of a flat ride to a hilly ride, again looking at time and intervals, and again another stabilization proprioceptive training session, which is about 45 minutes in total, but it just means we keep on top of little things. These are things we picked up when Sam sort of broke his foot in 2021, I think it was. He broke a bone in his foot, and things like that. They're just basically kept on top of that, and we noticed. And then on Sunday, it's the sort of the final, the fourth swim of the week, into sort of an LT2 run and an easy bike as well on top of that. So that takes it out. I would say
that fourth swim, what kind of swim is that?
That's an endurance. Yeah, so that would be an endurance swim. And again, I don't stick to these because obviously I can look at them and go, that's not the right session to do today. So it's not as though I have the sessions pre-planned, go, okay, this is what you're doing, this is what you're doing, this is what you're doing. Yeah, it's planned. We have an idea. But at the end of the day, it's when he wakes up in the morning, we see what's actually happening, see how his body is. We look at how he can actually absorb the training. And for me, it's the absorption of the training session is the most important part, not what you're actually doing in the actual training session. So if we have that format, but then again, if his body's not going to accept it, then quite often we'll say, okay, we'll just do a different session, or we'll change that, or we might think today, oh, can we do a little bit of this, or can we do a little bit of that? But that's the sort of, at the moment, that's the general structure we have. At the moment, sort of Sam's, I would say, he's up to around about 30 hours a week, which we've upped that. We've increased that a bit over this year, slowly increasing it as a youngster. So Sam's only still 24. I don't like to put too much load because obviously there's within the principles training, you have progression. So if somebody's doing 35, 38 hours now in 4 years' time, yeah, how much training does he actually have to do to carry on that actual progression? So it's a slow not a slow process, but it's a process going up. Yeah, so for example, we look at sort of the average hours over the last, let's say last year, we were just under 20 hours a week on average, where this year at the moment we're averaging 21 hours. So we've gradually moved that up on average. But again, it varies within the actual week itself. And in sort of, I break that down at the moment, sort of in over the last sort of over the last year, we sort of, it's around a sort of about 50-55% on the bike, 20-24% on the run, 20% swimming, and then sort of about 4% sort of strength training, and how that actually balances that out.
Well, that's a very good breakdown. Thank you for that.
No problem.
A lot of it is, or there seems to be a lot of focus naturally on, you said, Ironman pace and strength-based work and so on. So that's, you have Nice coming up in not too long now, but is that something that you find that you do a lot of even outside of the specific preparation period that is just some generally responds well to?
Yeah, I mean, for Sam has a huge aerobic base. He always has had a huge aerobic base. We don't really need to improve his aerobic capacity. What we actually look in trying to do is his sustainability at higher power or at higher speed, which then comes down for me to a lot of muscle endurance strength side of it. So we sort of look at the quality of the training and how his actual body is absorbing that strength sort of thing, working that way around. So trying to make his muscles a lot more economical, sort of improving the mitochondria or the number of mitochondria, or using sort of a better fat source, et cetera, as an actual training session. One of the areas that I sort of look at is, it's not about how fast you can actually go, it's how little you slow down in an actual race itself. So if we know he can hold, for example, 320 watts, which he did in Kona, how long can he actually can maintain that and then carry on and run afterwards? It's not sort of, yeah, I would say, yeah, it's not sort of I'm looking at LT1, LT2, or let's say aerobic and threshold. We're doing no sort of working in those sort of areas. We're very specific to the actual event and what we're doing, because we know, I know that we're focusing on Ironman distance. So realistically, do I really need to be pushing his threshold or his LT2 up as high as possible? No, what I'm trying to do is get his LT1 as high as close to his LT2 as possible. So we need to be as efficient as possible.
That makes a lot of sense. And in terms of the distribution between disciplines there, so percentage-wise, it sounds like, I guess, pretty normal for what yeah. you would expect a full distance athlete to.
I think Sam does a bit less strength than a lot of people. We're not very, as a strength training, everything we do is about stabilizing. And you're looking at the small muscle groups, looking at sort of, yeah, all the small muscles, the ligaments, the tendons, and everything else like that. And it's a lot of proprioceptive work as well as sort of stabilization. We don't tend to do a lot of sort of standard sort of weights where we're squatting or lunging and things like that. Everything is introduced that we can actually break into the actual sport itself. So, I mean, this is one of the things I used to lecture in when I was lecturing, is we would look at sort of exercise training methods and make it very much sort of, okay, what's the weakest part? Yeah, and then try and strengthen that part up in each individual discipline, if it's in his ankle, if it's in his knees, everything else, instead of looking at sort of, okay, let's make your quads or your hamstrings or your glutes as strong as possible. Yeah, it's very much about, okay, let's look at what the weakest part is and make that strongest. Therefore, the main muscle can actually work better.
That makes sense. So obviously, most people will have seen that Sam has a remarkable swim and bike ability, and he can run well as well. There's no doubt about that, but that's been a bit more inconsistent, I guess. But for the swim and the bike, what would you say? Can you attribute that to some specific characteristics within him or within his training that makes him so good?
Yeah, I mean, Sam's been, as I said before, he has a great aerobic capacity, always has had as a kid. And some people will turn over and go, oh, you shouldn't be doing that sort of thing. But for example, when we were, I think he was 9 when he did his first 100 kilometers on a bike. And then every year we sort of grew from that. So he did 9, then he was 10. I think at 13, we did 220 kilometers on a bike and had no issues at all. Actually, we were a group of 4 of us, and Sam was actually the better one out of all of us at the end of it. And then when he was 14, we did just in training. These were just objectives he had in sort of over the summertime. And we did a half Ironman distance in training. So we did the swim, we just went to the pool, got straight out, biked, and then did a run. And he did 4:45 when he was 14-year-old, and has no real sort of, had no real down effect. So we know he's got this huge aerobic capacity. So from a training perspective, I'm looking at building his strength up so he can actually work a lot harder on that. He can be as strong as he possibly can, so his body doesn't break down. And I think you're seeing that more and more and more in long distance triathlon or Ironman, is that athletes are getting stronger and stronger. If you look at Dietlef, you look at Christian, yeah, they're all very, very powerful, like strong athletes. They're not sort of lightweight, weak, not like light, sorry, weak is the wrong word, but lightweight athlete. You don't see them sort of skinny little things running around where sort of 15, 20 years ago, they were as light as it possibly can, where it was always, you know, it's power to weight ratio. And over an event that's sort of seven and a half hours now long for sort of the top end, it's how strong you can go without actually breaking the body down so you can keep going faster. So yeah, I would say for me, it's the swimming and the cycling is very much about sort of strength orientated. And where we're based here, from the cycling perspective, we've got hills, we've got flat, we can climb up to 2,300 meters in the middle of winter on roads around us. So it's a good training environment.
So if somebody recognizes themselves in that, that they also, for however they do know that, but they know that, okay, I have a strong strong aerobic capacity, but I just seem to slow down too quickly, too much.
Yeah, they haven't got the top end speed. Yeah, Sam was never a sprinter. Yeah, even though he raced short course and was racing quite well. I mean, he did his first pro race for a D1 team called Poissy up in from Paris up here. So the French D1 system, which is quite a big sort of strong system where you look at, yeah, I mean, Sam's raced against, all of them, Christian Blumenfeld, Alistair Brownlee, Johnny Brownlee, all of that as a youngster in that system. So they race against it. And Sam was always good in the swim and always good in the on the bike. But he never had the top end speed to be able to run a sort of sub 15 minute 5K, which is what you actually need to be doing to win those sort of events and also for the WTS. Mentally, the French system supported Sam and actually they took him on board because obviously he had the potential to be able to do that. But again, it wasn't something that Sam really enjoyed doing. And I think when you're getting that close into sort of into the sport itself, you've got to focus on what you enjoy doing more and more and more and not sort of just, I'd say, flogging a dead horse on the areas that you don't really enjoy doing. And I think that's one of the biggest things I've noticed and taken on board when he was racing or he was in the French Federation system. A lot of their training was very, very high intensity and it would take Sam a lot longer to recover from that. And it wasn't suiting him and he would break his body down. And okay, yeah, you get a good race every so often, but the rest of the time his body was really, really tired. And obviously when he then came back to me and asked me to coach him, I knew the fact that that didn't suit him. So we don't do a lot of VO2 work. We don't do a lot of LT2 work. At all. And I think retrospectively for Ironman, how much do you need LT2? How much do you need VO2? I think it's a minor part of it.
And strength work on the bike is pretty clear, I think, riding long rides, lots of zone 2 work, hills, and so on. What does it look like on the swim?
The swim is basically, we keep it relatively, Sam swims four times a week. The sessions vary from about sort of 5,500 to 6,000 meters. But my goal is at the end of the day is I want them coming out of the pool with arms dragging along the ground. Yeah, that's strength. And I see that over and over again. Sam's got a good technique. He's always had, and I worked on that from when he was a young kid. But people just don't have the actual strength to be able to maintain that that way again. So a lot of paddle work. I use, infamously use my stones to swim. So Sam sort of has these 500-gram stones that he actually swims with and does sets. Within that to improve his actual strength. That's not just to improve his strength, it's also to help improve technique and actually improve his swimming in a wetsuit. It's one of my, one of the things I've used for a number of years now. And just get them to have tired arms and come out of the water. They're not physically exhausted aerobically sort of it, but their arms are blown apart. And that's how you improve somebody's strength in swimming. And I think it's one thing that's really missed in training a lot.
And how does that play into in any way how you design the sets with in terms of the length of the intervals, recoveries between intervals, intensities that you use?
Yeah, I mean, it comes back down to how he is in the morning, how they are in the morning, and how they sort of progress through. But also, it depends on what time of year it is and whereabouts in the season and what their objectives are. Yeah, it's very much about sort of, okay, I'm very specific in the way we actually train. So again, it's not sort of, okay, I'm looking at zone one, zone two work or looking at threshold work. It's very much about sort of taking it to that point that we need to improve for that actual race itself. So it's very specific in the way we work. And also, I like to make things harder than they actually are. So when you come to race day, then obviously when you're racing, then it feels a lot easier.
Yeah. For the swim, for the Ironman swim especially, that makes a lot of sense because it shouldn't be too hard on race day.
No, absolutely.
Then so the run, I guess, what are you trying to do, if we go into a bit more detail than we already discussed, to just build that run up to be able to consistently close it out on the run?
Yeah, I mean, consistency. What is consistency? It's the world of Ironman and the world of long distance triathlon. For me, it's such they can't race that often because it's just taking too much out of them. So quite often we'll go into a race and go, okay, let's see what actually happens where we are at this moment. And again, the same thing. It's always the problem. So obviously Sam has this stigma of blowing up on the run. I mean, it's a bit harsh for me. If you look at sort of what he's done in the past, for example, such as last year, okay, you've got Kona, but also finishing fourth on the PTO ranking system, fourth in the both PTO races that he did last year. And then you look at a few years before where he ran a 2:42 marathon up in a small race up in the Lakesman in the north of England. Yeah, he's got that actual capacity to run. But obviously we need to put everything together. When you're racing for 7 hours, 7.5 hours, the smallest thing, yeah, if you're racing on the limit, can affect something. Yeah, so if he misses a water bottle or one of the water bottles is too highly concentrated or something else, then it can fall apart. And obviously that's what we're experimenting with when we're actually racing. I mean, he's been super unlucky for me this year with having sort of the liver infection that he picked up from open water swimming before Lanzarote. And then, say, coming into Roth, yeah, to, I mean, he ripped it, he tore his muscle, he tore his calf muscle, but he had a 3 centimeter tear in the actual calf muscle through the actual run itself. So he's actually on the limit the whole time through. Now, to combat that, obviously, we're just being consistent, make him as consistent as he possibly can, make it as easy as he possibly can. Yeah, so looking, okay, let's take 3 minute 40 kilometer pace and make that as easy as possible. So therefore, when he gets off the bike, he can carry on running at 3 minute 40 kilometer pace for as long as he needs to. Or 350. I mean, at least last year we were looking at sort of 350 kilometer pace and make that as strong as possible. But when you're on the fine line all the time, the smallest thing can obviously change that.
Yeah, actually, that leads me back to what you said before with a 3 liter per hour sweat rate. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty massive. What is right now anyway, realizing that these things maybe can change as you get more information, but what is the strategy to combat that kind of sweat rate? Do you try to basically...
It depends on the temperature. Consume as much liquid as you possibly can. Consume as much liquid as he possibly can, but also to cool his core down as much as he possibly can. And if you look at sort of what he did in Kona, where he was running along, grabbing hold of the big bottles and just literally drinking it and pouring it over his head as much as he possibly can, that's what we actually need. That's what he needs to carry on doing. If that means he has to slow down in a over a aid station to pick up because they only have cups, yeah, then he's like sort of throwing over as many cups as he possibly can. Over him and drinking as much as he possibly can, and teaching his body to be able to absorb the amount of liquid that he's putting into himself, or the amount of fuel that he's putting into himself.
What has been the amount of fluid that per hour that he has consumed? Maybe it's different in the bike and the run, but in the hottest races like Kona or even in Roth this year, he was very hot.
In Kona, we looked at in Kona, we calculated he was taking in around about 2 liters an hour of fluid. And that's also the same in sort of the PTO. We were looking at sort of 1.5 to 2 liters. It wasn't as high. I think Lanzarote, again, I don't think this helped sort of his liver. We knew that it could possibly be very, very hot on the bike, and it actually wasn't. Yeah, he was actually quite cool on the bike. And so I think he overdrank, where again, he was looking at 2.5 liters an hour on the actual bike itself to get on ready for the actual run. And I think it was sort of, there was lots of different things that sort of came together. And we need to learn to adapt as the race adapts within it. So it varies through the race. I wouldn't say there's one thing, okay, you are going to take 2 hours and 2 liters an hour for the next 7 hours. Yeah, it really does depend on what's actually happening and how that temperature is at that race. But a lot of it is to trying to keep the body, for him, to try and keep his body cool, as cool as possible. Now, Sam copes with the heat really well because he sweats so much. Yeah, but also, therefore, his body's cooling himself down. We just need to aid that, but make sure that the dehydration isn't as bad, and also keep the sodium balance in his body as even as we possibly can, so his body doesn't start shutting down, which is what we've seen in the past.
And what is your strategy with sodium? Is it to always try to match the estimated sodium concentration, or what strategy?
Yeah, I've spoken to a number of people and read them. It's one of my books that I read quite often. It's just called Sweat, and it's understanding about what the human body sweat is and how we can actually replace it and everything else. I would like to see an even balance. And now I know that's not possible. I mean, we're quite lucky, or Sam's quite lucky in the fact that his sweat isn't that salty. But then again, if you think of losing 3 liters an hour, that's a lot of sodium he's losing at the same time. So we try and keep it as balanced as we possibly can, because obviously, as soon as the sodium balance in the body is wrong, then the body will either try to get that balance right again. And a lot of people, I'll go into sort of detail, will be going along the run and they just can't stop peeing the whole time through. Yeah, because their body is trying to balance that sodium out. Or other people are there trying to get as much water into the system to neutralize that water, to balance the actual sodium itself out. Or they get cravings for crisps or peanuts or whatever it is while they're actually running along. I mean, I've gone through that myself, and getting the mineral balance is really important, I find.
Then one more question on Sam is around the big picture periodization around racing. You already said not racing too much, but actually when you said that, you said that you can go into a race and just see what comes out of it. So does that mean that you still are okay with racing, but maybe training through the races?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Training through races, everything else. I mean, it varies from person to person, and it depends. Yeah, again, it's sort of, from Sam's perspective, sort of a couple of years ago, you were looking at sort of, he was racing because obviously that's where they get money from, and get sponsorship, get time, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, and now sort of thing, since Kona and stuff and sort of the PTO, Sam doesn't probably need to race as much, but we still need to know what race prep is. Yeah, so the races are, if we're going into races, they're there. We'll probably have one or two key race sessions, races in the season, and the rest of the time he's like sort of, okay, let's see where you are, let's train through that, what's happening, what happened, can we change this, was that working well, was that not working well, as well as also keeping the sponsors happy by sort of being seen on the screen.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you mentioned the two fourth places in the PTO races last year, and I agree those were very impressive performances. So, but you said earlier that Sam's main goal is still Ironman, the Ironman distance, I guess. So, do you think on that, is it possible to be equally competitive at both distances, or is it almost a necessity to just choose one that will be your absolute main distance?
I think if you look at sort of what's happening in the world at the moment, with sort of Gustav and Christian and Ditlev there, you can be good at both. I mean, obviously the other end comes in, you get the faster boys coming down from sort of coming up to from short course or WTS stuff. But yeah, no, I think you can be competitive in both. Yeah, but again, it's what you're actually focusing, where your main goal is. And our goal is always the longer, the Ironman. Yeah, so that's always the focus, and we train through those other sessions and learn from that, or get a bit of publicity from that. It's always there as an actual as a stepping stone. No, also it's good fun. You don't become a professional Ironman athlete or a professional triathlete if you don't enjoy racing.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's move into the general coaching section. And here, I mean, maybe you can answer from an age group perspective, but if you also want to give an answer from a pro perspective or both, then that's absolutely fine. Yeah. So yeah, let's start by just you giving an overview of your coaching, let's call it philosophy.
That's what's complicated for me. There is no philosophy. Triathlon as a sport is quite complicated. Obviously, getting people in, having all different levels, you've got to understand them as a person and adapt. So one of the things that, and it's, I suppose I only really sort of came around with it as a philosophy, and it's not my philosophy. Somebody Dan Bingham brought it out within his book of sort of reverse engineer it and look at what their actual goals are, long-term, short-term goals, and then look at where they actually are. And see how we can actually engineer their training to be able to get their actual achievement. Yeah, it's not. And so, therefore, when I'm actually looking at sort of athletes, I look at a whole sort of. I'd like to look at sort of the last 4 or 5 years of an athlete to see where they've come, where they've been focusing on, what they've done, and see what if they've achieved their goals or failed their goals. Why have they achieved them? Why haven't? And then adapt the training around that. It's not as straightforward as having sort of okay, I'm going to use a polarized method of training because it varies from person to person. There's no one way to train the athletes, especially as age groupers, because obviously an age grouper has so many other things going on in their life, family, job, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. And all of those need to be taken into consideration. So we look at what their goal is, yeah, and then I work back from their goal and go, right, okay, this is your goal. This is where you're at. How can we get you to this level and then build towards that? So it's very, very specific.
Yeah. Well, with that in mind, I'm going to change some of the next few questions a little bit and give some specific examples. So let's say I am an age grouper and I want to qualify for Kona or Nice, the Ironman World Championships. That's my goal. I've never done that before. I've done one or two Ironmans, but I have gradually moved up through the distances. So I have a bit of a background, but I'm by no means like an exceptional talent. What would you say are the, how do you approach swim, bike and run training for somebody? And also let's say that they are pretty well rounded across swim, bike and run. So acceptable at all, but not excellent at any of them.
Again, it goes into their work and their social life and their family life. And how much time they can actually spend across to actually training, et cetera. Some of those, I mean, I get some people, they come in and they want to achieve this, and then I've only got 6 hours a week to do that. And it's like, it's not possible. Yeah, at the moment, over a long period of time, it might be possible, but at the moment, it's not possible. Yeah, so I would much rather sort of look at it from a realistic point of view. And then sort of if I can see somebody comes in, I want to qualify for Kona. Okay, we look at the history of what they've done and what they actually need to do. Yeah, there's enough data out there. There's enough information. There's enough results to say, okay, if we can make you this strong, yeah, or this fast, yeah, or this fit, yeah, then you have got a better chance, or you have got a good chance of actually qualifying for or achieving your goal. Yeah, or in this case, qualifying for Kona or Nice. Yeah, and so we adapt that through and say, okay, we know that obviously if you're going to go for this race, we could see the results from last year, how those little races went, and okay, where were you? How are we going to change that and build that up into that and build their strength around or their endurance, depending on where they need from their sort of their history they've had.
Yeah. So if going into the swim a little bit, and I'll ask it from this perspective, across various athletes that you coach or come across or talk with in general, if there were two things that you see that athletes that have some kind of performance goals, age group athletes, not professional athletes, two things that they... That a lot of them kind of get wrong or could improve by doing differently or change or implement. Can you give two tips for improving their swim training that way?
One is training too often. Yeah. So again, I've been in the lucky position here to have thousands of people come through our doors and actually see their level of their level of swimming and how much effort they put into swimming, yet they don't carry on progressing. Their technique is very good, etc., but they might go in, I've only got half an hour, I've only got 45 minutes, or they go to a club session and they're getting in sort of 2,000, 2,500 meters in a session, yeah, but they're doing it on a 4 or 5 times a week, yeah, or even some cases 6 times a week. And for me, obviously, you've got to recover. Yeah, you don't run every single day. to try and get better, but you will get better for a short period of time, and then you'll hit a plateau. Yeah, you don't swim. So for me, the tip is basically swim longer, swim stronger, but less. Yeah, so the body then has time to recover and adapt muscular to be able to then to swim better. Yeah,
that's so a good one.
Yeah, and I would say
it's an unconventional one. Like, yeah, I don't remember anybody else saying it on this podcast, but I do appreciate the perspective. And funnily enough, like if I look at my personal training right now, I'm at a point where I have decreased my swimming frequency. I actually haven't made the sessions longer. They're a standard like 4K every time, but I've decreased it from 4 or 5 times a week to 3 times a week. And I'm actually seeing some improvements, so maybe there is something to what you're saying.
recovery is one of the key principles of training. Yeah, and if you're not recovering, yeah, and I'm swimming, then I'm cycling tomorrow, I'm running, then I've got another swim. Swimming is also less impact on the actual body itself. And again, it's like what I said before: is you as my second tip, you want to come out of the water with your arms falling off you. Yeah, if you're not coming out of the water with your arms falling off you, then you haven't hit an overload principle. A lot of people, as a natural triathlete, we get our aerobic capacity from cycling and running as well. So we don't really need to be pushing that forward in the actual swim. What we need to be doing is making that distance feel as easy as possible. And this is, again, where people really sort of fall down. They go, oh, I want to do, a 1 hour 10 swim. Ironman swim, and they can do that in training, or their paces or their critical swim speeds or whatever their training, their thresholds would dictate to them. But then when they come to race, they're just not physically strong enough to be able to do that.
Same question for the bike. Two tips to improve your bike training.
Consistency. Be as consistent as you possibly can, and I think that works in all areas. And use hills. Hills are a brilliant bit of kit. Turbo trainer again is pretty good, but actually going out and going up and climbing down, or cycling down hills is one way to get somebody very, very strong, and also learn how to handle the bike itself as efficiently as you possibly can. If you're doing sort of a long ride, you see people go in there and they attack an actual hill each time they go there, and they're attacking, they're going faster than 30 seconds in, 45 seconds, they're like, oh, hang on a minute, this is not the pace I should be maintaining up here. And so they're not very consistent within sort of their strength or their power that they're producing up the actual climb itself. So that's the first one, is basically get out into the hills, learn to ride the bike in a hill as much as you possibly can, because it works on your handling skills for going downhill, but also improves your actual strength and your aerobic capacity, as well as your mitochondria in the body. And the second one is fueling. Make sure they fuel enough. We have lots of people out here, and you see them, they might go out there and they'll probably have sort of 45 grams of carbohydrate an hour in their training session. Oh, I'm trying to improve my fat metabolism. It doesn't work that way. Your body's fueled. You need to fuel your body correctly before, during, and after the ride to get the full potential of it.
Yeah. When you talk about consistency on the bike, do you still apply the same principle to swimming of also getting the recovery, not biking too often? So how many days a week, if you have the time as an age grouper, but you want to get the right...
Yeah, it's consistency. And obviously, for me, what you actually want to do is I would look at sort of endurance ride where you're getting a good bit of mileage. I'd say a minimum of 3 rides a week. If you can fit 4 in them, 4 rides a week is fine. But again, you've still got to let the body recover. I think we can sort of see that when I was talking with Sam about Sam and how many hours a week training. I know age group athletes are doing more training than Sam is at 21 hours on average a week over the year. And I see that a lot. And they're not letting the body recover properly. As 3 to 4 training sessions a week. Again, I would look at sort of using the hills, a lot of strength, probably a turbo train session because it's very intense and very, and you can get a short session in there, but learn the actual skill of cycling as well. Learn what it actually is to go downhill at 40, 50, 60, 70 kilometers an hour and actually start to enjoy it and get the actual skill of riding again.
Yeah, I think that's a great point because since the power meters have become basically ubiquitous. Everybody's focusing on the power, their race power, Ironman power. But if you have three different people going, let's say 250 watts for an Ironman, then there can probably be as much as a 20 to even bigger gap between the slowest and the fastest on a not super technical course, just an average course based on handling skills and where they apply the power and so on, aero position, of course.
Yeah, and for me, again, it's sort of just using power I think just using power alone is not very, not an intelligent way of training. There are so many other things that factor that into that. Using your heart rate as much as you possibly can, using RPE as much as you possibly can, you use all three things to monitor how you're cycling. Yeah, and sometimes you might go out there and my heart rate's low or my heart rate's high, and that could be affected by sort of the temperature outside. And again, we have that at the moment when people come into the summer. Oh, I'm running or I'm cycling really badly, my power's really down. But your heart rate's where it actually is, because that's what's actually marking your body as you, as an actual person. It's influenced by what's happening outside. Okay, you're not going as fast, yeah, but you're still putting to the limits, you're still training in the right area. So use as much data as you possibly can to monitor that training, from heart rate, rate of perceived exertion. I mean, with Sam, I'm using Moxie as well at the moment with Sam as well to train off, so we know exactly what's happening. Some people use lactate at the same time, so you're trying to monitor it now as an age group. That's very, very difficult to do that. They haven't got that facility, but more and more I see age groupers just using power to ride off. And it's for me, that's completely and utterly the wrong thing to do. They need to be using power alongside the heart rate and calibrating their heart rate zones against their power zones. And if something's not sat together, yeah, so their power is off or their heart rate's off, then obviously you then need to make a decision of what's actually happening. Do they slow down? Do they speed up, et cetera, or do they just turn around and go home?
Yeah. And same question for running again. Two tips to improve your running.
Two tips again. It depends on what they're training for. You've got to look at where their strengths are and where their weaknesses are, and then you've got to look at sort of improving. So if they're a speed person, is there any real necessary doing a lot of VO2 work or LT2 work where realistically they need to be building their aerobic base up? And people don't like running slow. It's just what, again, we see that out the amount of times I bring people up and go, okay, we've got to run slow, you're going too fast. No, but this is slow. No, and it's not slow. Yeah, if you look at your heart rate, you look at the pace you're going at, and look at what your thresholds and everything else are, it's not slow. And that's what people don't do. And over a period of time, that slow then becomes quick. Yeah, which then comes down to sort of Dr. Phil Maffetone and the Maffetone method of training. Yeah, it's very much like, okay, we'll slow everything down, and then suddenly that slow is not very slow at the moment. Yeah, and you look at sort of Dr. Ingo San Milan at the moment, he's talking about sort of zone two training and stuff and working, but their zone two, especially cycling and running, is still pretty quick. Yeah, so it's the same as like sort of with Sam. We're running in zone two at 340 minute per kilometer pace, if not slightly quicker, depending on the day, depending on the weather, depending on the location. Yeah, that is pretty quick running. Yeah, and it's not easy. Yeah, and so people sort of don't take that into consideration. They've got to work their aerobic function as triathlon for me is, especially long distance, is a pure aerobic area. So they really need to be working on their lower end base and then looking at sort of improving the VO2 and LT2.
What is the takeaway there? Is it that generally people run too fast too often, yeah, or yeah,
too fast. Yeah, too fast. Yeah, okay. They don't know how to run easy until their aerobic base allows them to run harder. They just run hard full stop.
Yeah. And do you have a second one for us?
Use again for me in running is I would look at heart rate drift. Again, a lot of people are again controlling their training and how their heart rate is drifting up against their power if they're using a stride or if they're their pace, and see how much is the actual drift between it. Is their speed dropping down as their heart rate's going up, or is their heart rate carrying going up, and then control their running by their actual their heart rate drift over that period of time. So if they're starting off at 140 and sort of over 20 minutes and they're up to 150, you know that heart rate drift is too big, yeah, and they need to be just pulling it back. to use use heart rate drift to control their aerobic capacity.
This is where, for longer runs especially, I find that with nutrition and hydration plays a huge part there, though, because if you do a good job with that, then you can definitely delay heart rate drift a long time. But so, and then when if you do see heart rate drift, then it can be a sign that, okay, like, I'm just at the limit of my endurance or my fatigue resistance, but it can, for a lot of people, because in running it's a little bit more complicated to carry nutrition and hydration, that it can be a sign of.
And that's always one of the difficulties of the difference between sort of a professional, or I would say professional, because I know some professionals that don't get the same support, or say Sam and the group that I sort of train with, against sort of an age group. Is if they're out cycling, quite often I'll meet them with the hydration at a certain point to make sure they're getting enough fluid in, etc. And it's the same when they're running. I'll be out on the bike with them when they're actually running. So if they need a drink, so I might be carrying a rucksack with 5 bottles in there and 10 gels. So they're actually getting their nutrition in, and that's the key part. Because also, again, something that age groupers sort of really sort of forget about is that they train and then go, oh, I'll recover after. But if they actually take their nutrition through the actual running and keep their nutrition at the right level while they're running and their hydration, they will recover a lot quicker than if they don't.
For sure.
I understand that obviously age groupers, it's very, very difficult for them to go for a run and they've got, I've got 2 liters of fluid with me because I'm going out for an hour and a half. They can't do that. So they've got to put a strategy.
Well, I kind of think that actually these days there are a lot of really good running vests that easily has the capacity to carry that amount of fluid, and they're still comfortable. So that's where I think you just have to invest in that one product that will change your life.
yes and no to a certain extent, because obviously I also find that people, I mean, if you take it, you've got 500 mil here, you've got 500 mil here, you've got another 500 mil at the back, and you've got 5 pockets on there, you're looking at a kilo and a half, 2 kilos of extra weight that you're actually carrying. Therefore, you're trying to run at a pace that you're trying to run with 2 kilos heavier. It has a knock-on effect. It really does sort of play with it. So yes, I agree with you. If you're doing an aerobic run and you're using a medium such as sort of heart rate to control it, or RPE to control it, if you've got 2 kilos or 2.5 kilos, you're not going to run as well as if you've got no weight on you.
That is true. That is a trade-off. But I completely agree with using heart rate there as well as to check in to make sure that you don't let pace dictate the run. But other than that, the nutrition side, if we talk about recovery within the training structure, do you work with up weeks and down weeks, or recovery weeks?
No, again, it's not. We periodize training depending on what's actually happening. So depending on where they are, where we test, or how we do our field tests, etc., we decide. We sit down and discuss where their strengths and where their weaknesses are, and how we can actually improve that, and where we're going to do, and then we'll work on a block of training that area until we get to a point of where we become a lot more race specific. We have high weeks, we have low weeks. Basically, again, I'm about consistency. I would much rather somebody be as consistent as they possibly can throughout that training. If they need to have a rest, then they take a rest. And that's my job as an actual coach. Let's look at it from a different perspective. If I was to do a 3 week on or 3 week high, or build for 3 weeks and then 1 week off, and that doesn't suit somebody, they're not tired when they come to the easy week, then that week's completely sort of wasted, in the same as 4 weeks. So I'd much rather adapt their training as they're actually developing. And we found that a lot of people, when they get to a certain level of aerobic fitness, they don't really need to actually have that downtime recovery week or recovery day, etc. They actually feel worse from it. And it's sort of basically keeping them controlled and keeping building that forward. And I know the periodization and the way we get taught to do periodization plans and microcycles and mesocycles and things like that. I think it can be, that just makes it a lot more complicated than it actually needs to be. Again, looking at reverse engineering sort of thing, okay, I want this person to be able to ride 180 kilometers at 240 watts, for example. Then that's what we actually build to do that, and do the training to do that, and make sure they're absorbing it. If they're not absorbing it, then obviously they need to ease back, and then carry on building that development forward. you don't look at sort of, it's probably a bad analogy. Look at sort of Formula One. They don't have down weeks to let all their people recover. Yeah. So they can then engineer something a little bit better. They're always keeping as consistent as they possibly can. I agree that you need to have sort of downtime in the year. Yeah. Where you might have 4 or 5 weeks where you're completely down. But in between that, for me, it's about as being as consistent as you possibly can. So I don't tend to have like build for 3 weeks, 1 week off, or build for 4 weeks and 1 week down, or having sort of a recovery day, in the actual week itself. Now we do have easier days, and I've done that in the past, but those easy days only means the intensity is easy. It doesn't mean the duration of that could be easier. Yeah. So when we're sort of in sort of winter time, I suppose for us, we would look at sort of doing a rotation where with some of my athletes, where we look at sort of doing the LT1, an LT1 day, an LT2 day, an easier day, LT1, LT2, an easier day and an own choice day, and building that into the actual week itself. So they have an idea of where they're actually going. Yeah. And we adapt that depending on where their individual strengths and weaknesses are. Yeah, it's not pre-planned.
Yeah, yeah. And what about strength training? Is that something that you would include in the training for an age grouper?
Again, it depends on them. Again, it depends on how time-strapped they are. I'd like to do a bit of sort of, as I said before, sort of stabilization and proprioceptive training, where there are people that have come out and seen me. Because then they can actually take what we've done, the exercises we've done, and I can make sure they're actually doing it right. I've done a number of videos for people and stuff like that about it, but I don't know if they're doing it right. I need to see if they're doing those sort of exercises to get the best function out of it. Now, I have athletes that will use sort of strength training because they enjoy doing it. Yeah. So I'll integrate it within their training because they actually enjoy doing it. But again, is it something that we actually need to get their goal? Yeah, is it something we need to be able to, that person to be able to ride a 240 for 180 kilometers, or run a three hour 10 marathon? Yeah, do we need that strength? Will it help us achieve that actual goal? If the answer to that is no, then we don't put it in. But if it is yes, then it gets put in.
Yeah. What about testing? How do you implement testing?
Again, it depends on what the facilities they have. Each an individual person. I tend to do a normal step test with most of my athletes, using heart rate against power, heart rate against pace, and then look at sort of the two deflection points, and we use that and develop that. I also use sort of the Maffetone test of basically looking at where their heart rate drift is. So I'll take their sort of mid-zone two, it's individual to each person, heart rate, and get them to run at that pace, and let's see at that heart rate, and be as constant as you possibly can, and see how that drops down from the cycling and the running perspective. From a swimming perspective, one of my favorite tests is 5x500 progressive, and see where they actually start falling apart on that. But again, certain people, they're not at a physical fitness level to be able to do that. So again, it varies from person to person. Sometimes I might just do a standard sort of critical swim speed test, as well as say a 1,000 meter as fast as it possibly can, just to see where their actual limits are at that time, and then use those. But it varies from person to person.
Are there any things that you would say for those time-strapped athletes that, that have, let's say, less than 10 hours a week to train, but they are still training for, in many cases, half or full distance triathlons? Any special tips that you use or that you would recommend people use?
Be specific. They've got to be specific to what they're actually trying to achieve. Yeah. If that's just to finish an Ironman, then obviously then you're going to look through, okay, you're just going to get as much time as you possibly can at an aerobic level to get yourself through that, through the actual event itself. But if they have a time, if they're after a time, so for example, 12 hours or whatever, then it's got to be specific training towards that actual time, because they're so strapped, they can't do a lot of junk miles. So everything has to be very, very spot on with what they're actually trying to achieve.
And now getting into some more, I guess, reflective questions. What is something that you've changed or evolved in your coaching in the last 5 years?
What haven't I changed? What haven't I evolved? One of the things that I do as a coach, and it's one of the reasons why I actually coach, is I learn off everybody. I mean, when you came to visit with Andy and all them lot came, it's about learning for me. Yeah, all the athletes have come through the doors, the sort of the thousands of athletes we've had through the doors. I'm always picking stuff up from them. Yeah, and as I say, it's sort of there's no sort of right or wrong thing. Everybody's got to. The example I use with a lot of people when they come out is if I have a room full of people and ask them to scratch their head, they're all going to scratch their head differently. So they tend to find that I've got to, as a coach, I've got to adapt of how they understand something. It's not the other way around. Yeah. And a lot of coaches I find are the other way around. And I was the same when I first started coaching. It's like, sort of, no, you've got to do it this way. No, you've got to do it this way. Or you don't understand. Yeah. And you sort of get not aggressive, but you fall out with them because they're not doing what you're asking them. And predominantly that's because they don't understand what you're asking them, or their interpretation of it is completely different to how you're doing it. And so therefore you have to learn how the athlete is and how they understand something to actually get the best out of that actual athlete. And I'd say also when I first started coaching, it was what I've adapted is I am a big supporter of them as an actual person, not just them as an athlete, but them as an actual person, because the outside influences they have, work, family, etc., really does affect their actual their training. And if they don't have that support, yeah, then it all sort of starts falling apart. Yeah, where that's what I am as an actual coach. I'm there to help them to develop, but also to support them. So if they have any questions, irrelevant of what those are, yeah, if it's personal or not personal, work-related or sports-orientated, yeah, I'm there to actually try and help them and give them an ear to listen to. And that's, I think, is what I've adapted over the years of being out here. That's what I've, I adapt the whole time through.
Yeah, that's a great answer. And if you could go back in time to when you were racing yourself, what advice would you give to you back in those days?
Get a good coach. Find the best coach you possibly can. Yeah, they're worth their weight in gold. A lot of people spend a lot of money on bikes. They spend a lot of money on running shoes. They spend a lot of money on wheels. They spend a lot of money on other things that are relatively different, where an actual, a good coach who's there to actually support you as an actual athlete is a big, big thing. I mean, when I went, I was supported throughout all my swimming career. And then when I came out to do triathlon, there wasn't that many triathlon coaches around. There wasn't that sort of area around. You sort of, okay, there's a running coach there. He might know a little bit about it and join that person. But at the same time, he's not the same. You need to find somebody who you work with, yeah, as an age grouper. And it's well worth the money at the end of the day. If it's not worth the money, then it's not a good coach and you should try and find one that is.
So if you had a good coach back then, what do you think they would have told you about? Yeah, is there anything that you can think of that they would have told you to change in how you were doing things?
Yeah, I mean, it's always having somebody to look from the outside is always interesting. Would they change? I don't know. Would they change what I did? When I was racing, I came from a swimming background and went into triathlon. And one of the reasons why I got into coaching was because I became ill with overtraining. Yeah, because I was just pushing myself into the ground. Now, coming from a swimming background at that time, we were swimming between 60 and 120 kilometers a week, as well as running three times a week, as well as doing weights three times a week. So we were overtraining, especially as a youngster. And obviously I took that information into the world of triathlon, and okay, it works for a short period of time. And then suddenly the body's like, hang on a minute. That's not good. So if anything, yeah, I'd say they would probably pull me back in the amount of training that I was doing.
Let me see here. Yeah. Are there any pet peeves you have in terms of bad advice or just bad practice that you see around in the triathlon world that people do or that you see in media or elsewhere? Anything, any myths that you want to dispel?
I don't know. It's difficult, isn't it? Because everybody's, again, it's the same sort of thing. It's how you understand something that is being told to you. Yeah. For me, probably one of the biggest things is how people understand when you're swimming, throw the water behind you. Yeah, where's behind you? Yeah, there's two different areas that can be behind you. That can be behind you underneath the water, or it can be behind you out of the water. Yeah, and each of them have a biomechanical difference to what actually happens to your body or propels you through the water itself, and it's understanding that. Yeah, so the bad habits are not understanding what the person is telling you 100%, or the other way around, the other person is telling you something that you don't really understand, and it comes back to a room full of people scratching their head.
And finally, you've given a lot of specific advice already about lots of things, but are there three more pieces of advice in general about whatever related to triathlon that you would give to age groupers listening to this?
Yeah, one is nutrition. Get your nutrition dialed in, not just in training, but also outside of training. Yeah, if you can, and this is the thing, is having, and that's my next one. Yeah. So get your nutrition sorted. So when you finish, you're eating very well, very healthy, and the right amount. And it's the same when you're actually training. Make sure you're eating as much as you possibly can, that you can teach your body how to digest that actual food as well while you're going through training. The myth of using sort of 60 grams of carbohydrates an hour, again, it varies from person to person. You need to learn or teach your body to how to digest the food while you're actually training, as well as when you come into a race. That's one, isn't it? What's my second?
Yep.
I've got one now. Got too close into that. The second big bit of advice is get as much support as you possibly can. Yeah, the more support you have around you from family, friends, physios, et cetera, that you can go, oh, I've got this problem, and somebody can answer it for you. Yeah, the better. Yeah, so getting a big support network, because I know obviously as an age group athlete and a strapped time, you can sort of, oh, I'll speak to that person. Okay, now I'll speak to that person, see what he says. I'll speak to that person. And then you as a person decide what's the best format of going around somebody. So you bring as much support into it as you possibly can. Probably the third thing is as consistency. Yeah, be as consistent through week in, week out. Try not to sort of go, okay, no, I can't do it this week. I've got to change that. You've got to try and work around and be as consistent throughout the whole year as you possibly can.
Yeah, that's great. And let's move on to the rapid-fire questions. So take one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
I've got two. The Law of Running by Dr. Tim Noakes. And then probably I would say The Big Book of Endurance by Dr. Phil Maffetone. Both old books, but got some useful information because they look at what was happening a long time ago. They don't just look at what's happening now.
And what's an important habit that you've benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Consistency. Well, that's not really a habit, is it? When people say you can't do it, I'll always try and prove them I can do it.
And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I've got more than one of them. So I would say, first of all, my dad. He coached me for a number of years. And obviously, when I was a kid, I didn't appreciate that he was actually coaching me and what he was giving me. I was just like, why the hell are we doing this? And then now I'm a coach. I can understand why he's giving these sort of things to do. Michelle, my wife here, who's supporting and sort of stood behind us and made the sort of bring the team together between us all, between Sam, myself, and Jake, as well as sort of having our sort of physios, et cetera, she brings sort of all of that together. And then probably my last one is a bloke called Robin Brook. He was the one who probably got me into triathlon. He's the one who got me to be a swimmer. He was the one who got me to be a physical training instructor in the RAF.
Great. And finally, Richard, is there any place where you people can follow you or follow your training camps and so on?
Probably Sam's the best place to look at, to be honest. I do have an Instagram account, but I'm not really into social media, to be honest. Looking at Sam, looking at sort of the podcast, I'm quite happy to do different number of podcasts, everything else. Look at what Sam's doing. There's lots of information there about me as an actual person, but I do have a Instagram account, which is Richard Laidlow. Simple and straightforward.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Richard. This has been great. I really enjoyed it, and hope to do it again another time.
Yeah, no problem at all. Good to speak to you, Michael. All right.
I hope that you enjoyed this interview. It was actually a long overdue one because, as Richard alluded to in the interview, I managed to spend a few days at the Laidlaw's back in March of this year. And we said then that we wanted to do a podcast episode. But yeah, here it is now, quite a few months later. But I'm happy with the end result, and I hope that you are too. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. One piece of housekeeping before we close out the episode is that we are finalizing some details about next year's training camp schedule. It looks like we will only be doing one camp next year as opposed to two that we did this year, but it will be great because we will be back in Mallorca in April. And when all the details, including dates and prices, are 100% finalized, I will open the registration for this camp. And at that point, I will announce that the registration is open here on the podcast, in the Scientific Triathlon newsletter, and on social media. But if you want to make 100% sure that you don't miss it, feel free to send me an email right when you hear this, and I can put your name down on an interest list, and I'll make sure to reach out to you directly as soon as we open registrations for the 2024 Mallorca training camp in April. Big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you are looking for electrolytes and fueling products, I would highly recommend trying them out. You can use their free fuel and hydration planner or even get a free video consultation with the team to prepare your race strategy. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS23. And thank you to Sennheiser. Use the Sennheiser swim trainer to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. Even if you have just 15 minutes at home available, you can get a time-efficient Sennheiser workout done that will help you swim better and stronger. You can try the Sennheiser risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on sennheiserswimtrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.